I'll tell you what, I'm delighted this evening. Oh, hang on, just let me get this right. I'm delighted this evening to have talking to me in a moment, Sandra Lee. And Sandra has been a politician herself, and I've listened to her from time to time when I have been able to catch her making some commentary on the political landscape. And it's good to hear it from somebody who actually knows the scene, who's been there, done that, but more importantly, who's kept up to date with everything and actually can give us some good insights. So I welcome to Radio Wātea this evening, Sandra Lee. Kia ora, Sandra. Nice to have you with us.
Kia ora, Miripeka.
Yes, it is nice to have you with us. And a long time no hear or no see. So how are you doing?
I'm keeping well, thank you, my dear. And you?
Very well indeed, very well. Well, I did have a shot at it for the general seat for the Party Māori. Didn't go as I expected, but nevertheless, if you're not happy with something, you put your hand up and have a go.
Absolutely.
So, and can I just ask, and before, I shouldn't even ask, but are you still living over on Waiheke Island?
No, I'm living down here in Whakatāne.
Oh my goodness.
Made the move 7 years ago, my dear.
Well, I am out of date. I am out of touch.
So we've been following our local MP, Rāore, over the course of the last 3 years, and what a result on the night.
Absolutely, yes, it was. It was a result on the night, and of course, with the special votes counted, you know, another two seats gained. So that was fine. I actually think that it was quite an outstanding success, really, because if you look at those four seats, that is definitely the Māori voters are definitely telling not only Labour, but they're certainly telling also New Zealand something as well.
Yes, I think there are several reasons why Te Pāti Māori did so well this time. First of all, Debbie and Rāore were rookie MPs for the last 3 years. They were all on their lonesome there in Parliament, in opposition, and in my opinion, they performed brilliantly. And the key to their success was discipline, solidarity, and just plain hard work. And our people saw that. And even during the leaders' debates, in my opinion, those two were the best performers. Their rangatiratanga was showing. As people like David Seymour and Winston and Luxton, even Labour, were quibbling and squabbling, they were just driving home policy. And because of that, they set the debate. Nobody wanted to talk about taking GST or food until the Māori Party started pushing it. So the rewards that they're reaping in this election have been very well earned, and the new MPs coming in, a very interesting mix, need to remember to exercise this that Debbie and Rāore have exhibited over the course of the last 3 years, and they will do very, very well indeed. They're a very different Māori party from the old one. You know, I think our people became disenchanted with the former Māori Party. There were divisions in the ranks, but they also voted for a lot of National Party policies, like increasing GST, that created a lot of dissatisfaction. But certainly this is a new Te Pāti Māori, and they're all for the hiss and a roar. I was so delighted to see Hana Maipi Clark get in, the little darling. As a long-time politician of my day, I worry for her because she's only a pepe, and even though I think that she will be able to handle herself very well indeed, she seems a very intelligent young girl. I think she'll find it a very lonely place. It's, let's face it, a lonely place for anybody, really. But when you're only 21... So I'm sure they'll take good care of you, though.
Yes, yes, I agree with you there. I think as if you're older, you've been a little bit battle scarred by life and your work experience, and so you know you can you can tend to look after yourself more and hopefully not take things so personally. But for a young person, it can be a very brutal environment. But as you say, she's got good, you know, good political colleagues there now that she's going to be with. And I suspect that they certainly will look after her. I know that. And I suspect that she'll grow very fast, very, very quickly. No doubt about that.
Morgan Godfrey made an interesting comment on election night at the point where Te Pāti Māori were in the lead in 6 seats. And he made the point that possibly had the Māori Party not taken Merepeka across when she resigned from Labour, they may have even taken the 7th. So I tend to wonder whether that was possible. All credit to Kushla. My word, what a campaigner. What a little battler she is. And she, there's always a wild card, is there not, Merepeka, in every election. And really, she was the wild card because she swam against the current, and yet she won the day and did very well indeed. But I suspect had Merepeka not come across to the party so early, before the election started, they may well have taken that seat out as well.
Yes, well, I was with Mecca on the day after, and she did say that she would be standing again for that seat, Tai Rāwhiti. And so, you know, but yeah, I agree with you, Kushla. My God, what a little! She was up and at him from the. She was out of that stall, going for it from the time that her nomination was confirmed. Boy, she was going. And of course, she was hungry for it. And good on her, and she put all her energy into it, and it came through. There's no doubt about that.
Holy heck, a real little pocket rocket. But I must say, the feedback that I was getting everywhere, including in Te Tai Tonga, was that all the Māori Party candidates were everywhere. They were highly, highly visible during this election campaign, and it's paid off for them.
Yes. And the other thing I think, too, is they made terrific use of social media.
Yes. It's an intergenerational thing, isn't it? And
if you look at
the makeup of the MPs, it reflects an intergenerational change. If you look at the way they campaigned, it was an intergenerational change. You know, gone are the days where you just stand on the side of the road and shake a sign at people. It was a very, very savvy campaign.
What I notice, Sandra, is that when I listened to them talking and debating, I thought, my God, you know the issues, as opposed to actually the run-of-the-mill members of parliament from the other political parties. And I believe they're going to be quite formidable on the floor of the House. You know, because, I mean, they know the issues of poverty. They know about housing and certainly social housing and homelessness. They know about crime statistics. They know about labour force participation. They certainly know the abysmal statistics in regard to Māori health. So they know these issues. And so if anybody's going to try and debate with them on those issues, then they better know their stuff because, you know, Māori members of parliament, they do know these issues and they can debate well.
Well, in my opinion, there's never been a more important time to have that voice out there so effectively than this election. Now, I got elected to parliament in 1993 and I used to help campaign for the late great Maturata, as you know. And so I've seen a fair few elections in my lifetime. And every election, the whistle blows and it's open season on our people. Yes, we remember Don Brash and then the foreshore and seabed and all the rest. It happens. You can set your watch by it. But this election for me, I don't know what you felt, was different. Because other than the Greens, and, of course, our Māori Party, our own people, it was really open season on our people. The race card was played, in my opinion, in a very, very dark way. whether it was a debate on whether to call a referendum on the treaty, act policy, or whether it was a debate on young ones getting into difficulty with the law, or whether it was our most competent and highly educated who are giving service in Māori wards on councils or in on co-governance entities. It didn't matter at what level of society our people were functioning at. It was open season on one and all. And frankly, it appalled me. And it made me feel very sad for our country that in 2023 we could see an election like that. And I've heard commentators say in the past, Maripika, no doubt you have too, oh, but it never works. But the truth of the matter is that it does. When you play the race card political parties during an election campaign, it actually does work, which is why they do it. But it needs to be stopped because it is so counterproductive. And as we look around the world today, whether it's the Ukraine or the Middle East or wherever, you can see societies that live side by side who are unable to live alongside each other. And New Zealand is not a country like that. So for those who claim to be political leaders, who go about playing the race card, inflaming anxiety, accusing tangata whenua of things that are outrageous, it just has to be stopped. We should be a more mature country than that by now. So need to thank our young ones from Te Pāti Māori in particular, but not only, other Māori candidates who showed very clearly that in this day and age, we are here with an absolute right to be so. We have something to say and it's important. We are able to debate and discuss and hold up the policy solutions in terms of the things that are impacting our own people. And that should be accepted and embraced by our fellow Kiwis with open arms.
Well, it does, you know, you're so right. It does say a lot about New Zealand. About our society when the race card is played at election time, and New Zealanders just switch straight away to believing the downside of what they're hearing. They're so I was going to say gullible, but they're so willing to believe the narrative that comes from part, like David Seymour and others. And other political leaders, they're just so willing to believe the narrative, and that tells me that they're not only gullible, but they're uninformed, and actually they don't really care. They don't care about having a decent society.
We had the ACT Party throwing out the notion of having a referendum on the treaty. That is what they want. I don't know what you think, but I doubt very much that Luxon will want all that goes with that on his watch in this government. But they campaigned on it. They made claims that the tribunal is creating the constitutional parameters of New Zealand and so on and so on. Now, listen, we had a referendum a while back when John Key was the Prime Minister on dope. Do we want to legalise it or not? Are they trying to relegate New Zealand's founding constitutional document to a referendum on dope? What political leaders who run this kind of line and create division where division does not need to exist need to understand pretty clearly what New Zealand would look like were it not for the treaty as it was written and as it stands today. Only a foolish leader would want to force tangata whenua off to the International Court of Justice, off to the United Nations, because New Zealand is a signatory to the Convention on Indigenous Rights, and I dare to say also off to the barricades. We don't need to do that in this day and age, and nor should we be twittering with the treaty as if it was some minor bill in Parliament will you make a few amendments at Willem 1? It must not happen, and it will not happen, because our people will not be able to tolerate that. Parliament itself only exists because of the treaty. And remember, every single one of those members of Parliament, no matter what their political party, every single one of them, before they can sit down and take their seat, has to swear an oath of allegiance to the King, his heirs and successors. And the treaty is between tangata whenua and the Crown, not any political party passing by in any political particular decade. So very shame on them, I felt. And it was good to see our candidates strongly rebutting and debating that very notion.
And you're right, it was good to see our candidates, you know, just making it very clear, first of all, that it's a foolish notion, and secondly, that certainly we wouldn't stand for it. But the other thing is, I would have preferred Chris Luxon to actually come out and categorically say, you're barking up the wrong tree if you think National would ever, condone taking that sort of action, and such as calling a referendum. And I would have preferred him to do that, because that would have been, to me, he would have gone up in my estimation, but he's sort of lukewarm about it. And that's what he needs to send, a very clear signal, not only to David Seymour and the ACT party and ACT followers, but actually to the whole nation, that this is how I intend to, you know, this is what I am in terms of leadership, and I won't dither on the real significant issues. So I was disappointed to see that he really didn't come out resoundingly and say, this is a no-goer, and don't even come back, don't even come again with that suggestion.
Yes, I strongly suspect that behind closed doors, as they nut out their coalition deals, that ACT will concede on that. I doubt very much that they walk away from ministerial portfolios over that one issue, the referendum on the treaty. It's not all bad. National have pledged to get rid of some legislation that I think needs to go. For example, an act went through Parliament just before the House rose. It's called the Natural and Built Environment Act. It's not like Three Waters, where everybody had a point of view. With this act, nobody really saw it coming, in my opinion, or not many people. But it's bad for everything. It's just bad law. And so you had this unusual situation in the Select Committee where you had the ACT Party voting against it, Te Pāti Māori voting against it, National voting against it, and so on. The Greens originally opposed it, but then they changed their mind at the last minute. But they pledged to abolishing that legislation. It's not good for our people. It has serious ramifications for us, amongst others. And it's good to see that that's going to get binned. So it's not all bad, and indeed even our man from the North, Winston, getting back, at least for those who may feel sad about it, I believe that one of his coalition deal bottom lines will be not lifting the retirement age above 65, which of course, again, even though he couldn't ever be accused of being a champion of our people, for all that, given that our men especially don't live long enough too often to get their retirement superannuation, it is good that he will be there to put a brake on the notion of increasing it at this time.
Absolutely. And you know, I hear what people are saying, that they, you know, oh, you know, fancy having Winston back and everything. But for all of, Winston is, first of all, he's a seasoned politician. And the only one who will be sitting around the table, the negotiation table, trying to nut out this coalition government and what that might look like after concessions are made and the negotiations ahead and bottom lines are thrown on the table, etc. The only one who's had the experience in that on two occasions, I think, with two governments, or might even be three actually, is Winston Peters. David Seymour hasn't had that experience. He certainly hasn't. I don't think he's ever been in a part of a coalition government. He may have been with National at one stage, but I think that might have been just on supply and or whatever you call it. And neither has Luxon. Winston is the only one.
Let's not forget that Luxon's a rookie MP like Rawiri and Debbie were. He was the first term MP last term. And in my opinion, he had a pretty cruisy ride because, if you'll recall, National changed leaders about half a dozen times. They were in one door and out the other. Then they had a Simon Bridges, and then he was gone, and Judith Collins, and then the chap from Tauranga who had a bit of a mental breakdown, and he was gone. So it was a revolving door till he came along. But what he had was, when he became the leader, the good fortune, ironically, of having a very, very small caucus. So yes, he didn't have a lot of people to wrangle. And so even though he's made quite a lot of the fact that he comes with, you know, high managerial level background, blah, 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 the truth is he had a very small caucus to manage. It'll be a different kettle of fish with two separate parties, with two separate caucuses to wrangle, and especially when you get to have such forceful characters as Tūngāpui, northern men like Seymour, believe it or not, and of course Winston. So it'll be a watch this space, and it'll be interesting to see how long Luxon will be able to hold it together. And I suspect that he may have difficulties because they're both such strong personalities, but also they have dialectically opposed kind of policies in certain areas, which is a recipe for war. So I'm giving it about 9 months before the sparks start flying.
Yes, and the other thing also is that you've also got, what's his name from up north as well, Shane Jones. Shane Jones is there. I mean, you know, obviously, and boy, he'll be supporting Winston, and those two will be quite formidable as well, along with the others.
Again, he's popped up more years in Parliament than Luxon, so it'll be interesting to see. It's not completely beyond the realms of possibility that if one of those parties resigned and Luxon lost his majority, that he might have to go cap in hand to Labour and ask if they would allow him just confidence and supply in order to be able to keep on governing. Yes. You know, it's a worst case scenario, but given the mix of the characters and the players in this coalition, it's not beyond the realms of possibility, I'd say.
And of course, we see with the election of the Māori seats with the four significant Māori MPs have now exited. Nanaia, Penny and Kelvin are staying on. Oh, well, actually, no. Penny, Kelvin and Tere Kātne. But those three are actually staying on because they're all high on the list. But Mahuta Nanaia is the one that's going. She didn't put her name down on the list, so she's going. But there's a lot of experience that's going in terms of, you know, them being there. Of course, they're still there.
Well, Medipik, I'd like to mihi to Nanaia. Mm-hmm. I remember in 1996 when this lovely young woman from Tainui came in, herself a very, very young MP. I've been trying to remember, was she 26? About there. So she was only a pepe herself back in the day. And from the years that I observed her, she was an incredibly hard-working Member of Parliament. She was a quick learner. And I feel a bit hoha with Labour. I feel that they gave Nanaia a hospital pass during this last term, and I'll tell you why. They made her the Minister of Foreign Affairs. first Māori woman. How beautiful was that? However, they also made her the Minister of Local Government. Now, those two portfolios, to the best of my knowledge, have never ever been put together in the history of New Zealand before. And it's got nothing about the individual MP, but everything about the work. So if you're the Minister of Foreign Affairs, a good Minister of Foreign Affairs is never at the cabinet table. They are out around the world pushing New Zealand trade. You know, the joke used to be, the minister's not here, he's busy in butter. Their job is to be out globally working New Zealand's interests. But when you give that minister, in this case Nanaia, local government as well, she's meant to be out every single weekend. She's meant to be out shaking the hands of every mayor and chair in the country, listening to their gripes, listening to their concerns, discussing climate change, talking about flood protection, talking about transport. And you can't do both jobs. They don't fit together.
No, so you're right.
She, you know, she was given an absolute hospital pass by just being given. You cannot physically be all around the world and in every region of New Zealand simultaneously, no matter how good an MP or minister you may be. So when the foreshore and seabed issue arose, I felt that Nanaia, like Pariana, took a very staunch position, but she voted for pragmatic reasons on the final reading to support it. But from that day to this election, Nanaia has never been on the list. She never, ever went back on the list, and she's always gone back to her people and asked for a fresh mandate. And on every occasion, she always got it until this time. And so this time, the vote has said time for a change, and they've gone from one extreme to the other. The most seasoned woman politician in Parliament to a young, up-and-coming 21-year-old, like Nanaia once was. But she's a big loss. Big loss.
I do agree.
In my view.
I thought she was, and the other thing too, the vitriol that she came up against, you know, moving around the country, talking about the three waters, which honestly is imperative now. We all know that councils are struggling and they can't keep up with the repairs and maintenance, let alone try and look at the pipe and the roadings and the pipes for warm water, storm water and wastewater and keep those up to scratch for growth. So it was necessary, but oh my God, goodness gracious, that was a shocker. Because that guy now, McInulty, that's all he's got is local government. I think he might have one or two of the small, very small ones, but that's what he's got, local government. So she was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and then I kept seeing, oh, why isn't she overseas? Why isn't she overseas? Well, because she's
damned if she doing if she was overseas, she was damned that she wasn't in New Zealand. In some region, if she was in some region, it was why isn't the minister overseas meeting heads of government here, there and everywhere? As I say, it was an absolute hospital pass. That was Labor's fault. It was a very bad call, and it put her in an invidious position. But it'll be interesting to see, and I'm thinking about East Coast people like Rawiri and, well, not just the East Coast, because the flooding's happening everywhere, but part of the challenge for our people will be to make sure that as we go about addressing the impacts of climate change, increased flooding and failing infrastructure, that the interests of our people aren't marginalised in it. For example, the last government had legislation around spatial planning, which is all meant to be about, to put it simply, we're all meant to be planning to head to the hills because of the impacts of climate change. Well, the first question when you're Māori is, whose hills are they? Because, you know, all the world's a socialist when it comes to Māori land. So when they're talking about so-called managed retreat and getting to higher ground, often the land that they're eyeing up is our people's land, in my opinion. They're not considering the titles that sit underneath. And the other thing is, during COVID, as you'll recall, day one, Grant Robertson, who I think was an excellent minister, slapped $65 billion on the table. Day one of COVID, $65 billion to get New Zealand through. And that was the right thing to do. I'm not criticising them for it. But boy, oh boy, does it put the treaty settlements into context.
Absolutely. Yes, that's right.
For the whole of Te Waipounamu, we've got 160 million. But when you see that the Crown can pull from behind its back 65 billion to keep business in New Zealand going and our economy going during an epidemic, it just goes to show that, you know, there's a context to everything. The word billion has never been mentioned to our people when it comes to treaty settlements. So with that in mind, really what the Crown has to do, in my opinion, is they just have to accept, especially in our poorer communities, that the councils can't foot the bill to bring flood protection assets up to standard. And our people are going to keep going under unless Crown sets up a revolving fund where they invest in bringing these stock banks and the like up to a state where they're ready for the new climate that we have to endure. And they've never wanted to pay. They've never, ever, as you know, ever wanted to pay or contribute to these stock banks here where I live. They were all built in the 1940s after World War II. They were never designed with climate change in mind. You know?
No, that's right.
But you look down the East Coast, you look in Kahununu, those stock banks failed horrendously during the flood this year. So the Crown, if they can pull $65 billion and put it on the table for COVID, they can put money on the table to make sure that the communities that our people mainly reside in are adequately funded and protected in terms of the assets that save us from going under. They can do it and they have to do it.
Well, that's right. That's right. And it is amazing that when they have to do it, they can find the money. So, you know, for their purposes. But listen, can I ask you, Sandra, did you hear or did you catch the program? I think it was over the weekend or might have been this weekend. And it was, I think his name was Jack Tame. And he was interviewing Lord Sumpton from the UK. And he was talking about COVID. This is changing it, but it's just a little bit. He was talking about he was talking about the world response to COVID, and he's then talking about New Zealand's response. And there were things that he was saying that I found very, very interesting. That to a certain extent supported what many of the protesters down in Wellington were on about. And then he also mentioned, of course, in the Scandinavian countries that Sweden didn't actually close their borders. They certainly didn't close their schools. It's just the big events they closed, and they tried to make sure that life could go on as near as possible to, you know, to normal. I don't know if you caught that. I found it very, very interesting.
No, I didn't see it. But what I'd say is hindsight's a fine thing.
Yes,
and,
well, of course.
In truth, I would give Jacinda Ardern an A++ for the way her and Labor handled COVID. The impact on our people in our country was far more successful because of the choices that they made than would otherwise have been. And it's all very well to look at Europe and sort of say things like, oh, look, they didn't close their borders and et cetera. But some of those countries have got some of the best health systems on earth. We don't. We don't. We have a lousy health system nowadays. We don't have enough emergency beds without COVID. Now, I grew up in a TB household. I spent my childhood going to the TB clinic with my brother because my great-grandfather, who was born in 1874, lived with us. And our beautiful old Kaumātua was riddled through with tuberculosis, and it was highly contagious. And my mother was adamant and diligent in ensuring that for us, she would never turn her back on her poa, her koro, but at the same time she made sure that we were vaccinated. And I'd say to our people, we just don't have the luxury of not being vaccinated.
Mm.
It is as simple as that. We don't have a health system that can support us adequately. This is not going to be the last international epidemic that hits us. So I think that Labor handled this extremely well. And I don't think that our people should take the risk that would be involved in being anti the notion of taking a precautionary pro-vaccination stance at this time. And I know that there's a younger generation of our people who feel very strongly anti-vax, but that generation haven't seen what I've seen. My great-grandfather had 11 children. He had 7 sons, and every single one of his sons died in infancy of tuberculosis. He had one daughter who died of peritonitis. He was left with 3 children from 11. My poa, my grandmother, died of tuberculosis in her 40s. So then he was left with 2 children out of 11. You know, we just need to remember the lessons from the past and take a very precautionary stance. That's what I urge our young ones to think about, to look at the history and remember what's happened to our people in the past with these introduced diseases. And before we get hoo-ha about the inconvenience or, you know, even the power of the state telling us what we can do and where can we go, I don't know that we should be drawing the battle lines here. And the bottom line in terms of the protests in Wellington was, when I heard that some of those protesters had defecated on the marae down at Pōneke, it broke my heart. It made me very sad, very, very sad indeed. So, yeah, let's look at our history. As Winston Churchill told the last Queen when she first became the Queen, the further we look back, the more clearly we can see forward. Thanks.
Very, very true, very true. So, look, thank you, Sandra. It's been wonderful getting your perspective, and I couldn't agree with you more and on many of the issues that have been raised this evening. Tell me, Sandra, now, are you fully retired or are you doing consultancy work?
No, I've retired from consultancy. I still like to stir the pot now and again, and I have been supporting very strongly the campaign for the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary and trying to make a contribution in terms of the clean-up of the Hauraki Gulf, which, as you know, has been a lifelong passion for me. And I can't say I'm winning it at this stage, but, of course, John Key announced the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary at the United Nations. So fingers crossed, with goodwill and good grace, maybe this term in this government, it may yet happen. You know, we have to leave something to that next generation. And even if we don't get it, the next generation certainly does, which is why, to come back to my point, when I see my old mate Hana Te Himara's grandniece in Parliament at 21, it warms the cockles of my heart.
Yes, yes. Oh, great. Well, look, thank you so much for talking with us this evening. Sandra, it's been lovely talking with you. Nice to catch up. And I hope we can do it again.
Up with you.
Thank you very much.